All right, well, welcome to this public lecture, which I think is probably the first time that we have done a collaboration between Geography and Environment and the Department of International History at the LSE, and if I'm right, that's well overdue. I'm Murray Lowe, I'm a political geographer, and I'm chairing this interesting event. So what I'm going to do is introduce David, say a little bit about his work, say the things I have to do as a chair, then David's going to talk for about, 45, 50 minutes, and then Ian Gordon, I will introduce him later, is going to respond. And then questions from the audience are, of course, absolutely welcome. David is Hans Grausing, professor of the history of science and technology at King's College London, and I may not have got that entirely correct, but I did have Carl Trudson, one of our Swedish colleagues, is here, and I had some language coaching earlier. In fact, taught me that it was a Swedish name, not a German name, and I think it's entirely appropriate. But a major reason why David is here is because of the invention of the Tetra Pak, which we all use every day, and we probably don't think about it, but it's just an innovation which has obviously just become part of our everyday lives, not just in the 20th century, but right now. Now, he is also, because he's got two jobs, which I think is kind of exciting, really, if you can get it, Professor of Modern British History at King's. And the occasion for this public lecture is the publication of his book, The Rise and Fall of the British Nation, A 20th Century History, Alan Lane Penguin, came out last year. As you can see, it's a very handsome, solid volume. It is coming out for students in secondary schools or other students who are around here in paperback in April. But David will be signing copies of this rather beautiful and rather solid hardback version in the hall after today's talk. And that's a very interesting book. I've read it. And it's kind of synthesis of most of David's preoccupations over his career, on a larger canvas, perhaps, in some ways, I'd say. I think David maybe started out writing in a variety of journal articles, as people do, but two in particular in the journal New Left Review in 1991, which involved developing criticisms of a view of Britain in the 20th century as being in some way stagnating or in decline. And the two targets of his initial criticisms in particular, if I understand it, but came from quite different places, sort of politically and intellectually, in the academy. Corelli Barnett, mostly associated with thinking about military history, and Perry Anderson, who most of you will know about, close association with New Left Review, of course, and with these overarching interpretations of British and European history. Then he followed up with a book about England and the aeroplane, which I think is 1991, is that right? Right, just about the same time, yes. Which tried to use this particular technology and its relationship to England, and the word England is quite deliberate here, and had the subtitle originally, An Essay on a Militant and Technological Nation. This clearly signalled what was going to happen later on in David's work. Several other slightly head-turning volumes followed. A volume on economic industrial decline in Britain in the 20th century. Another one on Britain as a warfare state, between 1920 and 1970. Also, more recently, 2012, I think, the book Britain's War Machine, which is a reinterpretation of expertise, technology, and strategy in World War II. He's also well known for a much more general book called The Shock of the Old, which tries to get us to think about the development of technology in the 20th century in a different way, and is in a sense a critique of a sort of techno-boosterism that's often associated with the new, with new technologies, with, well, you know, what you're doing on your phones, and all of that. And perhaps doesn't lead us to think in a more nuanced and thoughtful way about the technology we use in everyday life and what makes a difference across the world in terms of technology. So, you know, this book has got enormous amounts in it, so I thought I'd give you a quick broader context for what David's going to say about innovation as a particular theme that, you know, is discussed in the British context in this book. The first one, I'm not going to dwell on this, is this theme of a supposed British decline in the 20th century that I think we're all familiar with from endless discussions in the public sphere, you know, whether this thesis is correct or not. The second theme has something to do, well, we might say, with British ruling class formation. Or maybe something, if you're not happy with that thought or that language, with the British elite or with the establishment in Britain. It's long been thought as sort of semi-amateur, Oxbridge-y, muddling through a sort of elite in class terms, and David has interesting arguments and has tried to marshal evidence over time that the qualities and qualifications, crucially, of people in various state institutions in Britain are really belie this image of this old-fashioned, dragging along, pseudo-aristocratic ruling class. Thirdly, he focuses on the military and warfare in British history, and I think it'd be fair to say he doesn't do so from the point of a sort of conservative or right-wing historiography, which is something interesting about his work. You know, it's just over 100 years, I think it was last month, that Max Weber gave his famous lecture, Politics as Vocation, where he argued that the core of the modern state was its ability to monopolize the means of violence or force. And, you know, the social sciences have always had trouble with this, because we're not very good at talking about violence and force, actually. As David puts it, you know, more left-wing historiography has always had difficulties with these themes. You leave talking about war and airplanes and that kind of stuff to the other guys, right? And we all focus on welfare and social stratification and popular culture. But this is something that goes beyond history, sociology, other subjects. How do we talk about force, violence, military technology, war in the social sciences? So that's a major theme that David deals with. Here's this general critique of technology. I've already mentioned that, so I won't dwell on the shock of the old. But lastly, he obviously has a kind of historical geography of Britain, the rise and fall of the British nation. I think it's your most Mackinder-ish contribution, David. He has a materialist sort of theory of the nation. Going, you're not allowed in history books to do all this sort of theory, but that seems to be what's going on. Science and technological investment, development of the British state, expertise, building motorways, doing planning, factories, nationalised industries, National Health Service, BBC, all of this is nation building in a liberated post-imperial British state. So obviously, given what's going on in Britain at the moment, I don't need to dwell on the significance of this, but clearly it's an important set of thoughts, and it's not just about history, it's about geography in a kind of very basic sort of way. just a couple of quotes about David's new book, just to advertise it, so you buy it from him, and it makes it worth him coming. Colin Kidd in the New Statesman says, every so often a book comes out that the entire political class needs to read. David Goodhart, some of you know about him, in the Evening Standard says, forget almost everything you thought you knew about Britain in the 20th century. Richard Davenport, no pressure, David, here. Richard Davenport Hines in the Times Literary Supplement said, the rise and fall of the British nation marks the apotheosis of England's foremost revisionist historian. So, that's all I have to say about that. I've told you about the time sequence. If there's a fire or emergency, I'm not quite sure where we're supposed to go. But what I suggest is getting the hell out of here to Lincoln's Inn Fields. But as the current government might say, of course, in a smooth and orderly fashion. So, David, thank you very much for coming and talking to us. Think of your questions, not statements, questions, and we can pick some of those up at the end.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Murray, for that kind of rather brilliant summary of some things. you didn't mention this, but I'm delighted to be back at LSE. I was never formally a student here, but in the early 1980s, I spent a lot of time with friends in the government department. And I learned all sorts of arcane things about theories of the state, which I've been worrying away at all these years. And I also had an association with the Business History Unit, which was at that time the great centre for studying British innovation. Nowhere else in the country was addressing these issues systematically. And I learned a terrific amount from Les Hannah and others in that time. So it feels particularly appropriate to return today to speak about that very topic. Now, it's a commonplace that the British elite, in its public utterances at least, suffers from serious delusions of grandeur. And the problem has got worse recently. We have talk of the return of the Navy not just to east of Suez, but to the China Station. Britain will become, we're told, not merely a local, but a global champion of free trade. Now, these fantasies, of course, are easily recognised. But some are a little bit trickier to spot, when they're indulged in not only by Brexiteers. And what I have in mind is the claim that the UK has a unique strength in science, technology, creativity, innovation, and that this can be exploited to transform the nation's economic prospects. That's hardly a new story in 20th century, or 21st century Britain, but it's now itself reached grotesque proportions. It's the last refuge of deluded Brexiteers. And I hope that as a result of that, it will be exposed for the myth that it is. Now, let me give you some examples, because you may not have picked up on this particular aspect of Brexiteer idiocy. In her Mansion House speech last year, the Prime Minister called Britain a nation of pioneers, innovators, explorers, and creators, and saw the United Kingdom, which is a cradle for innovation, a leader of the industries of the future. And in a more recent speech, standing underneath the gigantic Jodrell Bank radio telescope of the 1950s, she said this: Britain would lead the world into the fourth industrial revolution, just as it had led it into the first. And she repeated the ambition to take the R&D GDP ratio to 2.4% by 2027, claiming that this would be more spending than ever before in British history. In fact, it was higher in the past, and more to the point, 2.7% will not put one amongst the leaders in R&D today. In fact, the levels of R&D spending today are under 2% of GDP. Nevertheless, this is not a problem. Sam Jima, who was the minister in charge of science until recently, said that Britain must return to its roots as a science and technology superpower, calling for a rediscovery of its spark of genius. And with a little more modesty, claims that the UK needs to follow the US in becoming a global hub of high-tech, research-led businesses. And Boris Johnson claims, we have an amazing economy. And he cited AI, stem cells, and other stuff. And then went on to say, the UK is once again taking the lead and shaping the modern world. It's obviously bullshit, but you can see it's the same bullshit again and again and again and again. And it matters to the Brexiteer argument. Listen to David Davis. At a time when the Commission themselves say that the vast majority of future global growth will come from outside Europe, it makes sense for Britain to place itself at the cutting edge of new technologies and the regulatory regimes they will require. Now, this is by far the best argument for Brexit I've ever heard from a Brexiteer. And I think it's for them a core argument. But the evidence for UK strength in creation, creativity, innovation is actually surprisingly weak. So weak is it that the government has taken to inventing statistics, fake statistics. Did you know, for example, this is from a Dexu document, that the UK space industry employs 40,000 people? 40,000 people. But 90% of this space industry, it turns out, is things like satellite broadcasting. Satellite broadcasting, GPS systems. It's the kind of argument which attributes all the output of agriculture to tractors, and all of the output of education to computers, or, well, why not pencils? That's the level of it. The brute reality is, of course, that the UK economy has stagnant and low productivity by European standards. It is a low R&D spender. And yet, we are in this world of unicorns, the technical meaning in startup world, and magical thinking. The discourse on innovation in 20th century Britain has been generally, actually, abysmally low, you know, full of the cheapest techno chauvinism. It relies on invented guiding principles from the past, completely invented so-called Haldane principle, which you'll find even now in an Act of Parliament, not to mention any number of white papers about research policy. It shot through the analysis with the most appalling category errors. And for geographers and international historians, it's a really quite interesting category error. It's the assumption that the United Kingdom stands for the whole world. That the nation state is the globe in miniature. In the case of innovation R&D, that cannot be the case. That assumption is made. You cannot assume the UK is a closed economy. And indeed, the central theme of what I'm going to be talking about in terms of innovation today is that the real innovation policy of the British government absolutely recognised the point that the UK was part of a greater system. And how it managed that was the central concern, really, of innovation policy. So, one last introductory point. One great problem with the literature on Brexit and history is that it assumes that history is destiny, that we are stuck either with being anti-European, because that's the way we've been since the Middle Ages, and that's a very good thing, and we should return to our true essence, or we are anti-Europeans because we are deluded imperialists and too full of ourselves to actually join in with Europe, in which case it's a disaster. So it's a story of continuity. But I want to argue that British history in the 20th century is a story of radical discontinuity. And we'll see that very clearly in the case of innovation policy. I'd like to start by going back to the 1930s and to show you a technological wonder of that time, a moving picture. And in this moving picture, you'll hear former Prime Minister David Lloyd George in retirement talking about potatoes. And as he talks about potatoes, he will reveal a deep secret about British research policy. So listen carefully to this. I hope it'll work.
When they discover that the insulin blue is a greater delicacy, they'll pay more for it. I've only been farming here just for a few years. And I did so largely because I was anxious to satisfy myself, not merely from statistics and from reports, but also from practical demonstration and experience, that it was possible to bring the poorer soils of this country, the inferior soils, into profitable and productive cultivation. This is the first crop it has produced for a very long time, except a very fine crop of weeds, luxuriant in growth, infinite in their variety. You can see what can be done by protection, I mean. In the way of production, by the help of science, which is a very different thing to protection.
Yes, science is a very different thing from protection, and that's the secret. As Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George sets up something called the Development Commission in 1909. And one of the main aims of this Development Commission is to do agricultural research to prevent, or to help prevent, more of a demand for agricultural protection. Science is the alternative to protection. Science is the alternative to stopping food coming in from abroad. And that is a very important argument in the story. The United Kingdom, before 1914, right actually up into the 1950s, has a unique place in the world. It is the world's largest importer of food. Something like half of its food is imported. And it uses ships like this, which, although not a British innovation, are characteristically British in that Britain has more of these ships than any other country by far. Now, for us today, a ship like this means nothing. They're invisible. But back in the first half of the 20th century, they are known to many people. And people would have known that these ships carry passengers, for sure. But more importantly than that, they carry refrigerated food in these holds. Meat, butter, cheese, fruit, on which the British people depended. So we have an extraordinary machine that can bring chilled beef from the River Plate. 80% of London's beef in the 1920s would have come on a ship like this. Fresh meat from the River Plate, dry-aged, 21-day dry-aged beef for the plates of Londoners. But there were nationalist forces who objected to this degree of importation of food and wanted to replace it with British production. So what Lloyd George is saying is, let's continue to rely on ships like this and we'll do some research on potato growing or grass growing to maybe stimulate our local agriculture a bit, but fundamentally to take away the demand for national protection so that we can continue to exploit our great advantage in foreign trade. And that policy is one that is pursued very successfully. I'll give you another example. There's something called the Empire Marketing Board, created in the 1920s, lasts until 1933. And its policy is in part to do scientific research. Why? Because the Empire Marketing Board, as a body, is there to act as an alternative to protection. We'll improve the marketing of imperial products and British products. We'll do research on them and make them better, but we will not have protection. Again, it's that trade-off. A very clear politics. And one of the things, actually, that the Empire Marketing Board does is to promote research in the refrigeration of food. And when the policy changes in the 1930s to have an element of imperial protection for food, a great discovery of the Empire Marketing Board is brought into play for ships like this. And that is that you put gas into these great refrigerated holds so that you can bring chilled beef not just from Argentina, which is outside the empire, but from Australia and New Zealand. You imperialise, in that case, your food supply through research. Now, in the interwar years, there is a great move to both nationalise, in the 1930s, to both nationalise and imperialise the British economy. And one very nice example of this is sugar. But before 1914, Britain imported sugar freely from around the world. And you might think that would mean, in the case of sugar in Britain, sugar from the Caribbean. But in fact, it wasn't sugar from the Caribbean. It was sugar from continental Europe, beet sugar from Austria-Hungary and from Germany. It's a great move to change that that import regime. And one direction it went in was to build, to grow sugar beet in Britain, that great vegetable of autarky, and to process it in new factories like this one in East Anglia. The second element was to regenerate the British West Indian sugar industry, as indeed happened during the 1930s. And as Sabine Clark has shown, that West Indian sugar industry wasn't doing terribly well in the 1930s, and the British government goes back to this fundamental Lloyd George principle of research and starts investing in scientific research on sugar to find new uses for sugar to avoid the need to restructure the West Indian economies. So science is a substitute for an expensive, politically difficult policy, deeply ingrained in this in this period. But there's also a more national focus for research emerging in the 1930s. This is a picture of the Imperial Chemical Industries stand at the Great Empire Exhibition in Glasgow in 1938, which no one knows about. We all know about the Festival of Britain in 1951. This was at least as big, but it was in Glasgow, and it was called the Empire Exhibition. So it didn't quite resonate in quite the same way. But Imperial Chemical Industries is a new chemical company for the nation and for the empire, as its name suggests. But its great policy in the 1930s, its great program in the 1930s, is to develop a process, essentially a German process, for turning coal into petrol. And British nationalists absolutely love this. Instead of importing petrol from foreigners on the other side of the world, you turn good old British coal, using miners who were unemployed in large numbers, to make proper British petrol. And the people who were particularly keen on this, no surprise here, were the British Union of Fascists. You can't open a BUF document without seeing a reference to this blasted oil from coal. Absolutely everywhere. But they're not the only ones. If you look at some Labour Party documents, you'll also see references to oil from coal, and certainly Conservative Party documents. And here's Ramsay MacDonald, who opens in 1935 the first great oil from coal plant. So there's a strong nationalist effort here. But all these nationalist efforts are limited. When it comes to the Second World War, the UK actually stops the development of some of these petrol from coal plants because they realise it's more efficient, as they indeed done in the 1930s, to import petrol from the other side of the world, specifically from the United States. You do not want to waste your national resources turning coal into oil. It's a very expensive process. You leave that to the Germans to do. Leave it to the Germans to undermine their own fighting capacity by turning precious coal into oil. So there's always a strong liberal reaction to these nationalist schemes. But we have, in essence, in the 1930s, a continuation of a liberal globalist research policy with research as an alternative to policy, an imperial policy, and a national policy as well. In fact, I should tell you about one more imperial policy, which is rather important: imperial aviation. Seen as a dead end, actually, these flying boat thingies. You don't see them in after that. Now, this is obviously some deluded imperial nonsense that retarded the British aircraft industry. In fact, every country had flying boats of this sort. What was unique about the British case was the sheer number. 30 or 40 as opposed to 9 in the United States. And they allowed air service to go all the way to South Africa, all the way down to Australia. It was a dream. This is dot, 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 to cross the Atlantic. A real state effort to create a new imperial machine to be operated, indeed, by Imperial Airways. So nation, liberal globalism, and empire. What happens during the Second World War? Well, the usual story about the Second World War is that a new British nation emerges out of the empire, that the nation turns inwards and finds inner strength through which it wins the war in 1945. This is the moment in which a new British nation is born fighting a people's war. The nation, sometimes, according to some Brexiteers, became self-sufficient in food. Somebody said the other day, we don't have to worry about Brexit. During the war, we fed ourselves, we can do it again. See? But it wasn't like that. The really interesting thing about Britain in the Second World War is that it fights an imperial war and an internationalist war as well. And one of the really interesting indicators of that internationalism is the way in which the British government lends to the United States its most important military technologies, because it wants to share them so that they can be produced in gigantic quantities. Aero engines, rifles, ships, cavity magnetrons for radar, gun laying equipment, proximity fuses, to be produced by everybody. And above all, the atomic bomb. The British atomic bomb becomes an Anglo-American product, but focused in the United States. But it's meant to be a combined internationalist project. It's not in the last part of the war, a British project. And indeed, British armed forces use American tanks. British transport aviation depends on American aeroplanes. The British economy depends on an agreement with the United States to be supplied with lend-lease goods so it can mobilise itself to the degree it does. You cannot think of the British war economy as a national economy in the Second World War, though Brexiteers now think it was. Britain never, ever, ever was alone, and had it been alone, it would certainly have done much worse in the war
than it actually did.
Now, why am I insisting on that particular account of World War II? Well, because I think, and this is the core argument of the book, things change in 1945. We move from internationalism and imperialism to imperialism and nationalism. And the atomic bomb provides us with a very good example. For we go from British participation in an international bomb, or it's an Anglo-American, Canadian bomb, to having a British national bomb, a properly British, properly independent deterrent. And that is what the Labour government in 1945 launches. And importantly, it's not an imperial bomb, it's not a Commonwealth bomb, it's a national bomb. There are no Canadians involved, no Australians involved in this British bomb. Indeed, Britain has a British independent deterrent until when? The early 1960s in terms of deployment. It doesn't have one after that. Of course, there are pretenses that we have a British and independent deterrent subsequently, but there really was one in the 1950s and very early 1960s. And it wasn't just a question of atomic bombs. There was a radical nationalism, in armaments, and indeed in aeroplanes as well. This is not a kind of sort of picture that you associate with post-war Britain. It's got a sort of modernist feel to it, which feels rather alien. But in fact, this is the Brabazon Hangar in Bristol. It's still standing. It was once the largest building in Europe. It's where the Concorde was to be built later on, but it was designed to build in order to have a place to build this gigantic post-war transatlantic airliner called the Brabazon. Yeah. It was a disaster, and it never went into production. But two were built. It cost an awful lot of money. They were out of date. But the point was that Britain wanted to have its own aeroplanes and not to rely on US aeroplanes for these important transatlantic routes. And that story goes on and on and on in aviation. This constant attempt to have the latest, most important aeroplanes, which will end up with Concorde as an Anglo-French attempt, to be sure, the last attempt to make a top-end British civil aeroplane. But it's not only that. I'll come back to Concorde a bit later on. The policy of national self-supply becomes very general indeed. Now, this is a photograph taken within an ICI plant in Dumfries in Scotland. And we see a worker here with a new fibre, a product of British genius of the 1940s. It's a fibre called Ardil, which, like this, nobody here will have heard of, for the very good reason that it was a failure. It was a fibre made from peanuts, from peanut proteins. It was a brilliant idea. There's a shortage of fats right across the world. Britain launched the famous, infamous groundnut scheme, peanut growing scheme in Tanzania, to extract the oil. But once you'd extracted the oil, which Unilever did, you were left with some protein. And brilliant British chemists and physicists found a way of turning this peanut protein into a fibre very much like wool. It's a wool substitute. And ICI, with British government support, build a factory to make this stuff. Harold Wilson, as president of the Board of Trade, has suits made up of Ardil, so they can travel around the world advertising this great product of British genius. Now, some of the imperial historians here might ask themselves, how could it be that a country that has a major woolen industry that depends on wool from the empire, the Commonwealth, Australia, it would dream of creating an artificial wool? That's insane. Yeah? Why upset your Commonwealth cousins by undermining their main industry. Yeah. The answer is actually, in the post-war years, there's very little differentiation between imperial economies and national economies, even though this is the great moment of imperial trade. And it's not the only case. Later on, under Harold Wilson's government in the 1960s, the British government invests in three gigantic aluminium smelters, making aluminium. Britain is not a country in which you make aluminium because you need cheap electricity. It's insane to do this. Yeah? And it's even more insane because who does Britain buy aluminium from? Canadians, yeah? part of the commerce. Or the Norwegians, who are an extremely friendly nation in EFTA, but nevertheless, you still go ahead and build these blasted, inefficient aluminium smelters. Why? Because you are in the business of reducing imports. Yeah. We think of the post-war years as liberalisation, Bretton Woods, GATT, WTO, all these things. And it's true that generally world trade liberalises, but British trade actually contracts as a proportion of GDP into the 1960s as a result of this deliberate policy of national economic development. And that programme of national economic development has innovation at its heart. Not just Ardil and Brabazon, but new trains, new kinds of coal mining machinery, new products of every kind, including, of course, weapons. And the quantities of money spent on R&D increase in government and in industry, approaching something near 3% in the late 1950s, early 1960s. 3%. That is, by the way, the Lisbon target of the EU for R&D spend today. So we have a national economy spending huge sums on R&D. And what happens? Well, the British economy doesn't grow very fast. It doesn't grow very fast, but it's doing all this research, and research and development, so the term of the era. And an economist called Bruce Williams, specialist in technical change, produces this graph in 1964 with some of the very early R&D statistics. And he shows here, this is R&D as a percentage of GNP for the 1950s, and this is annual rate of growth of productivity, for the same period. And you see the United States spends a lot on R&D and grows slowly. The United Kingdom spends a lot on R&D and grows slowly. Japan spends practically nothing on R&D and grows fast. And Germany, West Germany, ditto. There is indeed an inverse correlation between the rate of national R&D and the rate of national economic growth. Yeah. Extraordinary result. It should be the first law of science policy. It isn't. Yeah. In fact, specialists in science policy will deny the existence of this relationship. And I should add, by the way, that if you'd plot something like that today, you'd get exactly the same result. Yeah. It is a pretty universal law of research policy, but it doesn't fit with that nationalist imaginary, which has to suggest, of course, the more inventive you are, the more innovative you are, the faster you will grow. It makes complete sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Completely obvious that should be the case, except it isn't, for the very simple reason, when my geographical, international, historical imagination comes in, that most of the inventions that you use in your own country will come from abroad, unless you're in the United States in mid-century. There's always a choice between using something from outside and inventing your own. And for somewhere like Britain, inventing your own is probably not the wise economic choice. There might be other reasons for doing it, but you'll probably find the product from abroad cheaper. Your rate of economic growth, if it depends on technology, will depend not on your own technology, but on world technology. world. The world is what matters, not the nation. The logics involved are different. Now here's 1964, Bruce Williams. Bruce Williams becomes the economic advisor to the Ministry of Technology, Mintec. Now, Mintec is really important because there's a standard story in British political history which goes something like this. British governments have been indifferent to science and technology, with one great, or perhaps three great exceptions. Governments of the First World War, governments of the Second World War, and Harold Wilson's government of 1964. And one of the most famous speeches in British political history is the White Heat of the Technological Revolution speech, which leads to the creation of this Ministry of Technology. So it makes complete sense, doesn't it, that Harold Wilson's programme was one of increasing expenditure on R&D, where there had been little before. In fact, so it doesn't make sense that somebody like Bruce Williams, who thinks there might be too much R&D going on effectively, should become the economic advisor. And in fact, if we look at what the Ministry of Technology was doing, it was actually cutting back on grandiose British aeronautical projects. It tried to cut back on some nuclear projects. It tried to stop Concorde, but failed. The idea was that too much R&D, especially R&D fixated on prestige projects, was going on, and one had to have a much more commercial orientation towards these projects. No more Concords, basically, was the line. Mintec, by the way, was a great industrial ministry. It was a Ministry of Defence Procurement, it was a Ministry of Research, it was the Department of Energy of its time, it was the Department of Industrial Policy as well. It was everything the British government supposed never to have had. And indeed, that it was such a department was soon forgotten. So the idea is that Britain is like over-innovating in the 1950s and 1960s. But there was one area where Britain was innovating very, very successfully. And that was in the arts. Think about British pop music of the 1960s. The Beatles and the Rolling Stones invaded the United States in the way that Concorde or the VC-10 never did. And think also of television. Quality British television. Quality British television comedy. I want to show you an example of that. And I want that most people here are under 60. So you will never have heard of somebody called Brian Troshaw. But some of you have. I can tell. Brian Troshaw was very, very famous. So listen out for the name Brian Troshaw in the following. I hope this will work. Yes, some people recognise this. I'll interrupt it if it goes on too long. But,
good afternoon. Hartley's. Lovely day, isn't it? Tis that. Are you here on holiday or?
No, I live here.
Oh, jolly good. there's our sheep, aren't they? Yes, of course, thought so. why are they up in the trees?
Fair question, and one that in recent weeks has been much on my mind. It's my considered opinion that they're nesting.
Nesting? Like birds?
Exactly. Birds is the key to the old problem. It's my belief that these sheep are labouring under the misapprehension that they're birds. Observe their behaviour. Take for a start the sheep's tendency to walk about the field on their back legs. Now witness their attempts to fly from tree to tree. Notice they do not so much fly as plummet. Observe, for example, that ewe in that oak tree. She is clearly trying to teach her lamb to fly. Talk about the blind leading the blind.
But why do they think they're birds?
Another fair question. One thing is for sure, a sheep is not a creature of the air. It has enormous difficulty in the comparatively simple act of perching. As you see, as for flight, its body is totally unadapted to the problems of aviation. Trouble is, sheep are very dim. And once they get an idea into their heads, there's no shifting it.
But where did they get the idea from?
From Harold. He's that sheep over there. Harold. He's that most dangerous of animals, a clever sheep. He's the ringleader. He's realised the sheep's life consists of standing around for a few months and then being eaten. And that's a depressing prospect for an ambitious sheep. He's patently hit on the idea of escape.
Why don't you just get rid of Harold?
Because of the enormous commercial possibilities should he succeed.
What exactly are the commercial possibilities of avine aviation?
Bonsoir, ici nous avons les diagrammes modernes du mouton anglo-français. Ce n'est pas une bonne elle fait bien le propos du maintenant qu'on a eu les bains, comme ça, nous avons dans la tête le cabine. Ici, où se trouve le petit capitaine anglais, Monsieur Trapshaw.
Big Ben, whatever you are.
D'accord. Maintenant, je vous présente mon collègue, le pouf célèbre, Jean-Noël Chattopathy.
Maintenant, le mouton, je voulais vous aller, le mouton de l'Andine, pendant les wheels. Bon,
les wheels, ici.
C'est formidable, n'est-ce pas? Et bon, où? Après, je suis allé où la machine, de l'imagine, de l'avion, de l'avion, derrière le mouton, bon. Tchouk, tchouk, tchouk.
Merci beaucoup. Suivez la piste.
Pardon. Mais, où sont les bagages? Ou le voyageur? Casse pas.
Merci. Les bagages! Les bagages! Ils sont ici! Maintenant, pour la mer, comme ça, comme ça. Démonstration fantastique! Sur toi! Un, deux, trois!
Okay. You might think that was a one-off. I was going to show you the silly walk sketch. Because the silly walk sketch also features Brian Trubshaw, the test pilot for Concorde. That's why he was so famous at the time. And also figures the Ministry of Technology. The Ministry of Silly Walks is the Ministry of Technology. And it includes an Anglo-French research fellowship called La Marche Futile. It is not subtle, yeah? this critique. Anyway, to take the story forward, there is a lot of piss-taking out of British technological projects in the late 60s and early 1970s. Justifiably so. It's not just Concorde. But we shouldn't take that too far, because there is a radical transformation in British infrastructure as a result of these great national projects. There are new railways. There are new letter systems. There's a new telephone system. There's a new motorway system. But all the infrastructure of the nation is transformed by post-war research and development and investment. And one of the most important and least understood is the transformation of British agriculture. The United Kingdom, that had been exceptional in importing half its food until the 1950s, becomes by the 1980s essentially self-sufficient in food, at least the food you can grow here. And that is really very important, if I can take this forward.
Yeah.
It's very important because the reason that the United Kingdom had to have a net balance of trade surplus in manufactures was to import food and to import energy. In the 1980s, you had North Sea oil, no need to import energy anymore.
And self-sufficiency in food. Britain is suddenly full of cows and sheep and pigs and chickens. No need to export manufacturers in order to import food. In other words, Margaret Thatcher's policy of liberalisation, especially for manufacturers, and a lack of concern for net manufacturing exports is made possible by this great historical conjuncture. More than that, the whole privatisation programme depends on there being things to privatise. Millions of council houses certainly didn't exist in 1945, but they do exist in the 1970s. Electricity supply industry, completely renewed in the 1960s and 70s. In fact, we're still today using the nuclear stations that were being built then and the coal stations that were built then. On and on the story goes. That's to say, Thatcherism would have been impossible without this great national reconstruction of the post-war years, yet was precisely sold as a critique of that national reconstruction. In fact, the argument was that it didn't exist. You needed to unleash the forces of the market to modernise the economy. So, what happens under Thatcher with research policy? Well, an abandonment of the national reconstruction project and its related R&D commitments. Once you privatise your great nationalised industries and you open up the supply of equipment to those industries to world markets, you cease to do R&D in all those areas. If you no longer care about manufacturing exports, you stop caring about R&D in manufacturing. And what happens under Thatcher is the Thatcher governments, and indeed the Major and the Labour governments, is a removal of the state from what we call near-market research projects and a general relative decline in R&D spending. If we go to the 1960s, the figures are from the mid-60s, the UK is up there with the United States, way ahead of Germany and Japan. Way ahead. In the 1970s, it's still... If we go to 1980, it's still roughly the same level, Germany and Japan. But we see, I'll just go to that, it just falls away, and the figure, these figures are up to 2004, the level is still about, is still under 2% today. Whereas these other countries up here are increasing, some approaching near 4%. In short, we've gone from a situation where the United Kingdom is very clearly committed to national R&D programme to one in which it is relatively uncommitted compared to comparable industrial nations. And that is the product of policy. Absolutely the product of policy. And you could argue a sensible policy. We didn't want to have more Concords, more advanced gas-cooled reactors. Why don't we buy our iPhones from Apple instead of trying to invent a British iPhone, which probably nobody would want. But the point is, it is a radical, liberal, free-trading policy that has been pursued in the United Kingdom. So I'm not necessarily criticising this, I'm simply observing that something very new has happened in British history. Now, what we to an end is that we've had a policy, actually, of using research policy as a substitute for industrial policy. Just as Lloyd George had research policy as a substitute for protection and agriculture, we have research policy instead of industrial policy. And if you look at the industrial policy documents, industrial strategy documents, they're all about R&D. And they're about universities developing new gizmos that are going to be, if things work out, exploited by British industry. We've had this for 30 or 40 years. Ask yourself the question, where are these great British industries that have come out of British universities over the last 30 years? Where are these great British entrepreneurs that have transformed the capacity of the British economy? And if you ask that question, you'll get names like Dyson, Bison. A man who makes those disgusting things that spray germs all over lavatories. And what we used to call hoovers. Yeah. Or we hear about Luke Johnson, great entrepreneur. How does he make pizzas? Yes. No one in the world's ever thought of a pizza before. Yeah. Or French patisserie. Or Richard Branson. A great entrepreneur, isn't he? And what does he do? He runs trains. A great 21st century invention? I don't think so. Cheap air at airfares. I just remember Freddie Laker of the 1970s. Much more important figure. Now, of course, there are entrepreneurs out there, but on the face of it, there is no self-evident case that the British economy has been transformed by fresh entrepreneurial technological vigour. That, as I say, might be a good thing, but it hasn't actually, hasn't happened. And just to end, I'm going to go to George Osborne, who is Chancellor of the Exchequer, developed the idea of a northern powerhouse. He was a South Manchester MP. And one of the great elements of this northern powerhouse thing was to exploit a great British invention, graphene. Yes. Remember graphene? Yeah. It's transformative material. It's going to not only transform the fortunes of the University of Manchester, but the northwest of England, yeah, and the whole of the United Kingdom, and through that, the whole world. It was ready to go. At last, a great British invention to take us forward. So what did he do? He invested £50 million. £50 million. A lot of money for you and me. Yeah? But if you're serious about transforming a nation and say you want to build a railway to Birmingham, you don't spend 50 million, you spend 50 billion. Yeah? But what you get for your 50 million, you get acres and acres and acres of publicity. You give the opportunity for ministers, when talking about industrial strategy, to say graphene, 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 graphene. And indeed, I want to suggest to you that pretty well all the talk about research strategy is a substitute for industrial strategy, and it bears practically no relationship to any actual technological development. Let me give you this example to finish.
It's fine.
I'll finish. One of the great technologies that Britain has this superb lead in, according to the Prime Minister, is battery technology. Yeah. Very important. Green futures and decarbonising the economy. The whole world is going to need fantastically new British batteries. The only problem is there is no British battery maker. No British battery maker. Yeah. So all the batteries that are used in Sunderland by Nissan are imported. All the batteries that are used in these London buses, electric buses, come from China. You see. And all the batteries that Dyson is going to use for his electric cars all come from Singapore and China. There is no battery industry in this country. So you have a policy of supporting R&D in batteries that you can talk up global Britain, but no actual battery production, and certainly no hope of British-owned battery production in this country. Yeah. And of course they know that. So that's the parrot we have. We have the use of research for essentially propagandistic purposes rather than transformational purposes. But it wasn't ever thus. Yeah. We had this extraordinary period in mid-century when R&D was part of a national industrial economic agricultural strategy, which did transform Britain for good or real. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Goodness, David, thanks so much. We're going to sort of move over here, I guess, because we've got three chairs, so let's use them. Ian Broughton here is going to respond. What can I say about Ian very quickly? Emeritus Professor of Human Geography here at the LSE, and well known for interventions in a number of areas around migration, the geography of labour markets, economic clustering, and therefore, I guess, innovation in an urban context and an expertise in development issues in London and the South East in particular. So Ian's going to talk for 2 minutes, and then we'll get some questions from, well, I guess there needs to be a little bit of a response, and then we'll get some questions.
Good, thank you very much. Thank you very much, David. That was a really great lecture. I have to confess, I had no idea how it was going to end up. I got the slides weekend. There's no text in the slides at all. That's it, there's no heading to this graph, so I had all sorts of interesting interpretations of this graph. Not the one you meant to know. And I have a degree of puzzlement. And some of the puzzlement, I think, is perhaps about genuine questions, and some of it is just my puzzlement. First of all, can I say how really great it is to have you over here from King's. King's is an educational institution which is apparently quite near to us. And the geography department used to be a joint school with the King's a long time back, and we've never quite got over that in the geography department. And sometimes the Rio Strande down there seems like it's a border with police movements across it, especially for Latin American-born people. Information services here actually wouldn't give me access to your file. They sent it straight to junk mail. So there's something very suspicious about it. So it's really good to have somebody over actually intellectually communicating with it. I really, really enjoyed the lecture, and I really, really enjoyed the book. And I'm not quite sure how I put the two together, or how I get the big theme of the book about declinism. I don't quite map onto this terribly well, and I think maybe there's something interesting about this. Can I say what I admire? I mean, what I admire in the book and in the lecture is the, I'd say, empirically driven verb. It is the two things together. So there's loads and loads of facts going into it, some selection of these facts, obviously, and there's an enormous energy, and there's an enormous critical energy, and there's a set of targets out there that have been picked off as effectively as by Monty Python, and maybe there's a borrowing of a style somewhere along the way. I don't always understand the positive arguments in this. And for instance, just in relation to the book, which isn't quite enough, I don't really understand why declinism mattered. Right. So exactly what declinism is, I may not have quite grasped, but it's not just about a claim that the British economy has been in decline since some decades or some centuries, whichever it is, but that there is an explanation for this and has something to do with the class structure and has something to do with the dominance of amateurs. And tonight you've shown us that the dominance of technocrats may not be a good thing either. So that's some of the kind of balance around it. But I don't really understand the evidence, if there is, that declinism actually mattered for anybody except the New Left. So I think there's a half-convincing, two-thirds convincing argument that you make that the New Left might have been a lot more effective if they hadn't been prisoners of a particular version of this explanation of a British decline. But sometimes you seem to be arguing that there was no British decline, and that they've misunderstood why there was it, if there wasn't it, if you understand. So I don't understand that. Or really the suggestion that the performance of the UK economy has been adequate, which I think I get from the book strongly, and I get it actually tonight to some extent. I get it from this graph, because if you put your two graphs together, the first graph says, hey, there's no connection between research and development activity and scale and growth performance. And by the way, we might be really interested in growth performance, it seems to me, and by the way, we might be interested in productivity, which is not something actually talked about much, but people would expect to be linked to it. But by the end, you seem to be bemoaning what had happened to research and development levels. While at the beginning, you were saying, this is all money that's wasted. Now, whether it's wasted or not, clearly must depend to a large extent on what it's spent on. And you didn't talk too much about the balance of that and whether pruning that at some stages actually had increased the efficiency of it. But I don't quite understand this. But it does seem to me, if the period you talk about is the 1960s to 1990s, which I sort of remember, well, I was a civil servant in the Department of Economic Affairs from 1965 to 1971 during the Wilson era. Well, I did dig out my copy of the National Plan last night from home, nice grey document. And I didn't read every page of it, but I don't think it says innovation anywhere in it. And that's quite interesting. It talks about research and development, I'm sure. It talks about investment a lot and growth. But I don't think we were... I'll come back to this in a minute. But if this period between 1960s and 1990s is a critical one, then I don't quite hear what it is that you're saying went wrong after that, or during that. That's perhaps you could clarify a bit more, and especially in relation to innovation. Now, I'm not sure what you're saying about innovation, except that a very large proportion of what's done actively through government support at all times has been the product of usual political behaviour. Gestures, misunderstandings, short-termism. Short-termism is not something you actually talked about very much, but one of the pervasive things which I think people would have said in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and now is that the whole system, whether it's amateur or not, is pervaded by short-termism. And the short-termism of politicians is part of this, but maybe the short-termism of engineers is too, in keeping projects going. But beyond that, I'm not sure what the lessons are from this, as to what we should be doing in terms of innovation policy. Third observation, which is, again, more connected with the book in a way than with the lecture, that I want to make. I was struck by the resonances between what you were saying and Geoffrey Searle's book, 1971, but written during the 1960s, called The Quest for National Efficiency, which is about a bunch of people in the turn of the last century, the 1890s through to the 1900s, who thought that the British economy was in decline and had been in decline for some time, and they had a social explanation for this partly, and they wanted to have a much more efficient government, they wanted more technical input into it, they wanted more business input into it as well. And one of the ways they perceived this was by setting up the London School of Economics. Yes, and I think maybe Imperial was also part of the same programme. So back way behind the period we're talking about, there were people who were strongly into declinism, maybe about the similar declinism or not, and maybe they were right then, and maybe that is when the decline set in. But I'm interested in what connection you make between these two kinds of episodes. At the time, then, it was a reaction to a crisis. So it was supposed to be a reaction to the Boer War and British failure, loss in the Boer War, and maybe insufficient shock value to that to actually do anything serious. So they failed in most of their efforts at transformation. The LSE survived, but nothing much else. And I don't think the LSE has transformed the British economy, actually, or British society, certainly. So
that bit will get edited out of the podcast.
Can I say it again? You know, there is no recipe for this for any of these things, that's what I'm saying. But just to pursue that thing a little bit further, so what they were talking about was national efficiency. But I think national efficiency might be something like productivity levels, and it might be something like growth levels, which I say is the two variables which really did obsess in the 1960s, I think really does obsess now. And everything else about balance of payments was a constraint, no more than a constraint for most people except nationalists who obsessed it. But I was looking at engram as the sort of the cheap way of doing research, and you shove some words in and you ask how often these words used at different periods of time. And if you shove in efficiency, creativity, and innovation into this, you get some extraordinary graphs out of this, which suggests that nobody used the word innovation in any European country seriously, sorry, serious numbers, until somewhere after 1960. So there's some transformation. Efficiency is a really important category, which, but innovation and creativity grow up together from the 1960s, absolutely explosively. Now, the usage of them increases by factors of scores over a relatively short period of time. So something different is happening in this period. And it's something to do with globalization. It's something to do with the deindustrialization of advanced countries as part of that. But I wonder if you could say something about that and how that actually affects the process and the change in the notion of what improvements might have to be, moving from talking about R&D and research to innovation in a pervasive sense as characterizing organizations and people and so on, not just a small number of projects, because I think that is one of the big questions about an innovation policy, isn't it? How much you pin it on R&D, where you target it, whether you're thinking about trying to make everybody innovative or not. And I guess that's probably, you know, except we said something where towards the end there was no self-evident case that something. And that seemed to be one of the lessons. Actually, there was no self-evident case that anything. I'm serious. But this is one of the messages, is precisely this, that all sorts of things we take for granted might dispute. At this level of empirical evidence, there is no self-evident case about it. And certainly, there's no even half-evident case that the government knows what it is. So I'm kind of all for industrial strategy. If I had a clue what it was that it was supposed to contain inside this box. You know, there was an industrial strategy in the 1960s in the plan. I can't remember what it would be beyond boosting investment and targeting some industries. It's not the case that we haven't tried industrial strategy, but actually what you put inside the box is the problem. I don't think you've got an answer to that. And expecting governments to do it is not either. I'll stop. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for an excellent talk.
Thank you.
That's what you don't feel we have to respond in enormous detail. Just so we can get some questions. But we do have time, that's all right. So.
I can't respond briefly to this point. But I will say this. I want to absolutely get away from the discussion of decline and declinism and being too evaluative about policy or coming up with a policy programme. I just want to tell you very simple, which is just to describe what's happened over time. Because I think that's what's missing, actually. A straightforward sense of how things have changed in research policy. We have all sorts of inventive declinist stories, which I could tell you in tedious detail, that have affected policy right through the 20th century, thinking about policy more importantly. But I think we just need to get away from that and just start describing what went on before we get on to thinking in new ways about policy. But I wasn't necessarily, just lastly, I wasn't necessarily bemoaning the lack of R&D in the recent past. In fact, I think I went out of my way, I thought at least, to say that this might be a good thing that we're doing less of this.
Oh, there's two good things.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one? You don't talk at all about comparing, you have some graphs which compare.
Yeah.
But the story you tell doesn't actually have comparison.
The story I told here doesn't have any comparison, but I have told the comparative story.
Because it seems to me in the 60s, one of the things which really got to me, I believe, was that the French were doing better.
Yeah? I mean, not in R&D spend.
No, not in R&D spend, but in growth.
Everybody expects
the Germans to do better, but doesn't expect the French to do better.
Yeah.
So the answer must be planning.
Yes.
And somehow these comparisons are important.
So they certainly. But R&D is not the answer. It's the only point I'm trying to say.
I agree.
Well, thank you everyone for your patience. Just a couple of things. I hate Twitter, but if you have Twitter, there is a hashtag I forgot to mention earlier. Hashtag LSE Innovation, I believe. It is for this evening. Be aware that when we get questions, there may be, I'm only allowed to say there might be, a podcast, an audio podcast, I believe, in this case, looking at Isbon, yes, which may or may not appear over the next couple of days, but do be aware that if you try to advertise, you know, your company or the latest meeting of South London Maoists or something like that, you know, you'll be recorded forevermore in history and maybe not in a particularly great way. So, questions. We've got a bit of time, but not. Please don't give a talk if you see what I mean. So, I think you had your hand up first. So, do say who you are. It is helpful. You don't have to. I don't want to force you, but I think it helps the rest of the audience to know who's asking.
Alan Brenner from another London Institute, UCL.
All right. Yeah.
In a different life, a long, long time ago, I was involved in a very junior way in industrial policy in the UK. And it was the 1980s, and the view was that the UK car industry was rubbish, and that the industrial policy was to actually import the technology and the manufacturing process from the countries that were stars in this, principally the Japanese. and the idea was inward investment, bringing in at that time Nissan, Toyota, Honda. That was the industrial policy. I wonder whether you think, you know, how does that fit into, let's call it, your model that you picked up there?
Well, yes, exactly. We have a very radical liberalisation of the economy from the 1980s onward, absolutely. And we do need to recognise that that's the policy that was pursued, and that we have a car industry that's almost entirely foreign-owned, and that has consequences for how you think about a nationalistic research policy. I don't think we're there. We have essentially a nationalistic research policy and a global strategy for industry. So that's exactly the problem.
Yes.
What is your...
Can you tell us who you are, if you don't mind?
Dr. Keith Bosler.
All right.
LSE PhD.
Oh, right. Great.
Do you have a view, or what is your view on the development of financial products from the city, for instance?
Mm.
This is perhaps one contribution of the LSE to the modern world is supplied to do this.
In other words, this has a relationship, perhaps, or does it not, to innovation?
It does. And actually, one of the things I argue against in the book is the view that throughout the 20th century into the late 19th century, British capitalism was fundamentally financial and based in the city. Which has been the standard thesis for elements of the right and elements of the left, and it has profoundly affected the way we understand British industrial history. And so that may well have been true before 1914 into the 1920s. It was not true, really, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. It's gone back to being true, but it's true in a very different way today. Back before 1914, British capital was the dominant capitalism in the world. British capitalists owned the trains of Argentina. Today, foreign capital is owning British trains and British nuclear stations and British airports. So yes, that is very important. But I don't accept these arguments from the New Left and many others that suggest that British capitalism was kind of formed before 1914 and it's been the same beast ever since. No, it's transformed itself radically more than once.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
I did.
Yes. Good.
David Brown, formerly of King's Forum, actually. So this is quite an open-ended question, so getting angry like this. But my view is, despite maybe overall variations in R&D, there have been sustained development of clusters. So what is your view on sort of regional variation, and how does that impact your account, basically, R&D? Like, I mean, for example, Cambridge is biotech, and this has been effective, so I've heard. How does that basically work with big accounts?
Right, an expert on clusters sitting next to me. Clusters are clearly important. The cotton cluster around Manchester, shipbuilding, and the Clyde, and Tyne, and all this kind of thing. Very, very, very important indeed. And connected to the rest of the world, rather than to the nation, before 1914. For the more recent past, talk of clusters, yes, clusters are there, and there's policy to encourage those kind of clusters. The case of biotech is really, really interesting. There's a study of British biotech since the 1970s, done partly at the LSE, which really shows how limited the actual success has been in terms of producing new products.
Is that producing or monetizing?
Producing. People have made money. Out of selling companies, but not out of selling products, is the point. So there's a lot of emphasis on valuation, a lot of evidence about valuation of a particular firm, but very little evidence as to what the value of the output has been. So yes, clusters, but it'd be interesting to know, let me make it more general point, actually, it'd be really interesting to know what the actual effectiveness of research policy based on clusters and university spin-outs in the last 40 years has been. And I've asked this question to people in research councils, and they get very flustered. And after a while, they do this. They get this. They mess around in their pockets and they say this.
And you know what they're saying? They're saying ARM, Great British Invention, came out of it. As if I'd not heard of it. Well, I've heard of it, and I looked into it, actually. And what the connection between ARM development of whatever it is and Research Council policy is a complete mystery to me. I think it's non-existent. But it's really interesting that there is no solid body of evidence, and it's not to hand with the Research Councils, that would point to great successes, even over a 30, 40-year period. I think that's very, very telling. They're not in the business of generating and reporting on success. They're another business.
Hmm. Yeah, okay, and I'm watching. So, yeah. What do you want to tell us who you are? I think you're from history, aren't you? Yeah.
International history. Can I... So you started off taking some sort of well-merited pot shots at the Brexiteers, but can I sort of be provocative for a second and suggest that the sort of the tale of discontinuity which you're telling us, the sort of the underlying message that actually the British economy has changed and is therefore changeable and of malleability, doesn't this actually sort of give a little bit more substance to some of the things that might otherwise be dismissed as unicorns? Sort of, we know the British trends have changed over time. You've shown us also that innovation and everything else has changed. So doesn't this suggest that in a sense we can make our own country for each generation as we see fit?
Absolutely, well spotted. Yes, indeed, that is indeed a possible reading, and one that I'm not as attracted to. I would like to see a different policy, radically different policy. So what I think is particularly tragic is that there isn't a real alternative policy out there. That Brexiteers have actually no policy for Brexit. This is now notorious. But there is room to have an alternative policy, and there's a Lexit policy out there in principle, and not, I think, at all well developed. But yes, absolutely. I can certainly imagine, for example, growing more food, making fun of that poor, unfortunate Tory of the Second World War, but actually wouldn't be too difficult to make the UK self-sufficient in food today. Just go back to the 1980s, we'd all be eating a lot more potatoes and turnips and stuff, which would be great, but you know, we'd survive. There are lots of other things, and indeed we could have a proper national reconstruction policy that depends on national investments in R&D, and I'd say that Jeremy Corbyn in his heart of hearts is that person, is that 1970s we are going to get British capitalism right at last. There's no real plan there. But absolutely, I mean, part of my point is that one could go in a number of different directions. So I think it's interesting then that the Brexiteers insist on historical continuity. They have a much better argument if they listen a bit more to me and emphasise discontinuity.
I think we have time for one more question. I'd really like to hear from someone who isn't a man or an academic, because I know we've got lots of A-level students here tonight, actually, which is wonderful to see. Anything quick? A-level students? Anything you want to ask David? Here's your chance. Doesn't have to be a complicated question. In fact, a really quick one would be good. Yes, brilliant.
Hi, I'm a Yetol student actually. I was just wondering on your opinion on this idea of like fluctuating amounts of R&D in terms of whether you talked about declinism or not. How would you think that this affects like social capital, things such as trust? How do nationalist views affect social capital?
Yes, that's a very interesting question actually. I think it's a very important part of being British in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s, to believe that one lived in a country and was part of a culture that was particularly innovative and creative. But this was the place where, where radar, television, the atomic bomb was created, that the very stuff of modernity was British. And if you read Harold Wilson's vision,
in this period. He makes this argument, and he goes as far as to say, we gave all these wonderful things to the modern world, and the modern world exploited them more than we did. The modern world owes us. We didn't get the patents right, or you know, we didn't make the right agreements with the Americans in particular, so we lost out big time on. And I think that does something for a country, that idea that it's important in the world and does good in the world, and that, through those sorts of inventions. Does it engender trust? Well, I think perhaps, but it certainly engenders a sense of common purpose. So I wouldn't want to sneer too much at that. And I mean, go back to the declinist thing. One of the points I want to make is that, contrary to the declinist argument that science and technology and modernity had no part in British elite culture, they're actually everywhere. And all this stuff was a source of pride to people. But you can't find a British Prime Minister who doesn't refer to science. I mean, I'm not picking and choosing when I put up Lloyd George. They're all at it. So there's something kind of very modern about British self-understanding in the 20th century, which we miss if we just look only for the references to the past or to the countryside. The British national narrative utterly suffused with a sense of a particular contribution to modernity.
Wow. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Gary Weir and Ian, for the contribution. And of course, if you would like exciting, although slightly heavy, copy of David's book, he will be inscribing them out there somewhere in the corridor. Thanks for coming along. Yes. Thank you, Ian. It's very good.